Succession number 27226, Reel 3.
Final hook, Reel 3.
Yeah, okay. Well, the one aspect about the Navy that was changed by the Fleet Air Arm, believe it or not, in my view anyway, was that there was an upstairs and downstairs situation where the troops, you never went into the PO's mess and the PO's never came into your mess and this was a complete division. That in the Fleet Air Arm couldn't happen because the men who looked after, and I feel very strongly about this because nobody recognises what those blokes who were looking after aircraft did in a carrier in the tropics. That must have been absolute murder because it's so hot in a tin can, they can't move, but you have to have a relationship with them. And if you don't have a relationship with the boys who are looking after your own aircraft, in the Navy anyway, your aircraft doesn't get looked after properly. But if you do things that means that they can understand, that you understand them, you get more out of them, unquestionably. And I always quote this as an instance because you've obviously had some talks about swordfish. If you start a swordfish or you start some American aircraft, you wind an inertia starter, okay? And when you wind an inertia, that's hard bloody work. And all that energy that's put into that, a pilot can sit inside and pull a piece of string and the clutch engages and his engine doesn't fire. And half of that is due pilot finger trouble. They hadn't got set the things right or something gone wrong. And then it's got to go outside and wind the bloody thing again. And probably, in a swordfish particularly, it might have flooded the port. It could have done any one of a thousand things. And so the second time he's got to do it again. And I always made a point when we were in that situation where we didn't have, you know, tips and electricity and everything else, that if I didn't start the aircraft in two spits, I went out and did it and they sat inside and did it. The net result was that the aircraft were always perfectly serviced, they recognised what I was doing and they do things for me. And personally, that was, you know, instinct really, personal instinct. And it had to break down that barrier. Now, I got up against that again later on, when, you know, 4 or 5 years on, when we had a similar situation. I came back from abroad and I was resting at Leon Solent, waiting to go to Whale Island. And I was flying aircraft, but not in a squadron, not in a squadron environment. The aircraft were there and I could fly them. And we were working with the troops because we were lining guns and this sort of thing at Lee, and working very close to them. And it was easy to do. What else do you do if you're not flying? You don't sit around just looking at yourself, do you? And so you got stuck in with them. And the Marine wings at Lee at that time was a Marine. He was a Marine Major with military army attitudes. And he logged me, and my I think it's in there somewhere, inclined to be too familiar with ratings. And I taxed him about it. I said, these are the blokes I got to rely on those to get my aircraft done. Why shouldn't I be familiar with them? Why shouldn't I call them Bill, Tom, Dick or Harry? You know? And the Fleet Air Arm did that. The relationship between the troops and the pilots was different from the ratings and the officers in the Navy. Very different.
At Shotley, you were introduced to maybe the old-fashioned style then of naval life, which was that would have been pre-war, would it? Those POs who come back on reserve, they would have had a very pre-war attitude.
That was the Navy of the old. That was the way we were taught was the Navy as it was in the 30s. It was. You were there, you did what you were told, you moved, you were an automan, and then you've got a little bit more freedom because a rating has to think a little bit more. But basically, you got it as it was.
You said that you the relations with those POs, though, because of their fiddles and their little things, was easier for you in a sense, was it? Because they would give you a certain amount of freedom.
Well, it was subliminal. They knew that we knew, but we also, as a group of people, we were doing what they wanted us to do, so their life was easier, and so was ours, you know. But you get some groups that were going to there, and POs kicking them to death, and they start kicking back. We've got a problem. So we got the best out of them from a training point of view, because we could talk to them, and they got the best out of us because we were learning what to get into the Navy. And an indication I always remember of all the people that actually did wrong, I don't know what he did, I think he was caught thieving or something, was an EastEnder. And he went today, had 90 days in the slammer, and he came back, and nobody ever wanted to go there again. He changed colour. He came back, it was grey. That was the Navy of the old days, that was not nice at all.
What was discipline like at Ganges itself for minor misdemeanours?
I didn't find it a problem. And I don't think, overall, that any lads on our course did. And we were a group, so we did what we were told to do. And don't forget that within the group, when you're teaching a thing like Lots and Smices, for instance, there are a lot of laddies there who were sharp. I mean, the grammar school, but there's no question about it, that if you take the norm, the grammar school boys were the sharpest of the lot. And then there was the next ray down, and then the ragtag and bobtail, of which we had our fair share. And but we taught each other. We were learning Morse code as well, of course, at that stage, I think. I know we were doing St. Vincent. We're certainly doing flags, identification of flags, A, B, C.
What does that entail, the identification of flags?
Well, how to send messages by flags, you know. You know that? I've got to stand up and show you. I'll stand up, isn't it? No problem. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J.
So it's almost a clockwise...
Clockwise, yes.
...alphabetical thing,
yes.
Yeah.
That's what we learned. You learned Morse code by flashing, but only in the basics. I don't remember. I must say, I don't remember much about Morse code at Ganges, because it was superseded by the Morse code I learned at Vincent. But we were taught... You see, you wanted to know all the troops are in there, they're inducted, to find out what they could do. And some boys would have a mental ability, visual ability, and the flags are still part and parcel of the naval. You get instructions by flags anyway, certainly in that time you did. And so these are all part and parcel of the training ethic. It's difficult, it's a bit of a blur, really.
Were all the recruits keen to learn within your group?
I don't think they had an option. But the point was that we changed the question of whether they were keen or not, purely because of the relationship within the group itself. We were all together trying to get somewhere. And it was a question of the way we integrated. They were all pals together, even though one was abroad, the Yorkshire, one was a Newcastle Geordie. And I mean, things keep coming back. You see, imagine as a person like myself or a rough EastEnder, and we both get thrown into the pot. And part of our duties, we had to go out on patrol into Ipswich. Would it be Ipswich? Where the hell it was? To check in all the pubs for all the people on the train, because the Beehive and Mitre were out of bounds to naval whitings that week, but down the corner was the George and Dragon, so they just moved from one to the other. But you went as a patrol. And within this patrol, you've got one person, and one person in charge, by yourself, nobody with you, to go around as a patrol, going into all these pubs to say that nobody's fighting anything else. Me, I was 5 foot bugger all, skinny as a rat, and no teeth. I had all my teeth taken out as well, and that was things you had to do. And for Christ's sake, if you got the wrong bloke with you, it's, you know, you didn't want to be fighting with him in for food as well as there. You know, you have to be together, and it worked. We were just thrown together, and we had to find ways and means, and we didn't have any real backsliders in the place at all.
You mentioned earlier, you touched on the fact that there was a Geordie recruit who became your minder.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
What was that about?
Well, I don't know, he was literally just a 5 foot bugger all, and he was how can I just, well, I was there, I charged everybody, I bought the papers for them. We had a gramophone, we had records, we got an organisation running, you see. So I was there as sort of the boss man in the group. That's me, that's ego. There were four of us selected as, and I was bugger all, you know. I only weighed 10 stone 7 or something, and I was the same height as I am. But I was one of them, was picked out. There was the laddie from the rugby play, he was one. Two pals of mine, one went into the Fleet Air Arm actually afterwards. There were four of us, had little badges around their arms.
And this was the course leaders, was it?
The course leaders, yes. They were split into four of us, so that the course was split into four, so that that group does that.
What was the badge? What did the badge look like?
Oh, a little blue badge with a crown or something on it. Just a wrap round here. And that's the one you had when you went on patrol as well. Some of those blokes couldn't read, you know. We had a Daily Mirror. We got the paper in. They used to read the cartoons and look at it. And there was music. We had records. We organised ourselves within the limits of our funding. And that was right. I mean, we played cards. We were a pack of cards, a card school at the end of the room. We were not supposed to play cards. And we had a rat run for the Rennery. I was going to tell you about that. But that was a bit naughty. But this was the way things went on. You did it.
How did the Geordie guy become your minder? Was he
pardon?
Would he just...
Well, he took a shine to me. And we worked around together. It was all part and parcel of this business of the PO's tobacco and everything. It was just like America on a small scale, you know. You did things, you had somebody look after you. He had to be bigger than you and be prepared to you know, because you could find yourself in roughies as well as everything else. It's a bit vague now, really, but he was... You see, we did things. Now, for instance, a handkerchief cost tuppence. All that place, people were pouring in, new groups, every week. They came in, they were green as grass, and all they wanted to go out was dress up and to the, you know, attract the birds in a bloody navy uniform into Ipswich. And the girls knew everything that was going on, but never mind, they wanted to do it. And of course, what's the first thing that Navy bride wants to do? You've seen a naval collar, haven't you, when you get it originally. You don't want it dark navy blue, you want it pale, don't you? We've got Clorox, we painted them, we ironed them out, we took their old one in, charged them something for the new one, and they got that. It was became commercial in many ways. They wanted the trousers pressing, you know, the way they used to, the way we were told to concertate our trousers and everything else. Well, that wasn't the best way, really, for a tiddly matter to go. You put a gusset in you know, the other gussets? You know, put a gusset in your trousers. And you either concertine them, and they couldn't be bothered to do it. They couldn't, you know, how to use a bloody iron. Handkerchiefs cost tuppence, wet water, iron away, charge them. we gave it back to them in things that they got in the mess. I can't. The main things, I think, was the magazines, really, more than anything else, even the only pictures, and the gramophone, of course. A very basic life, I suppose, but in our place, it wasn't ordinary. We did things, and we did things we could get away with. It was a bit different.
How did you deal with friction amongst the group?
Pardon?
How would you have dealt with friction amongst your group of you were looking after?
I can't recall any real friction. I think it was fairly peaceful because we were all stuff in the same group. And if anybody stepped out of line, you see, the old minder was there. It was if anybody stepped out of line, it was like to get thumped. And you know, if they're threatened and they know somebody's going to thump them and he's bigger than they are, they're going to be, you know. And he was a tough little character. So he was killed on the one that blew up the hood. He went down with that.
Now, you were about to tell me about the rat run to the Rennery as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, the Rennery... The Rennery was not very far away, and we were all surrounded with wire netting and barbed wire. And we weren't far away, so we cut a line through the barbed wire netting and went along there so the girls could go there and the boys could go backwards. And when I had my 21st birthday party there, I took over the, not the naffy, where the hell was it? There's a photograph. all my photographs were lost. I had a party over there with all the Wrens and all the boys on the course, and Warrender was there and the matron and everything else. And all the boys and girls who knew each other all went into this for a party. That was a good do. A pity I haven't got those photographs. I took them up to show some friends in Nottingham, and my car broke down, and they were in two big bags, and I took them out, and I believe the people in the garage were looking at them and left them there, and they got lost. But they were all of the Ganges era. It was a great shame. But yes, the boys were doing the thing in their own quiet way. I don't know what happened in the other place, but we were close to it and we did something. we were a bunch of... for Christ's sake, we're just youngsters, really. I had my 21st birthday party there, which was, say, in the Rennery, which was quite good. We were bombed, you know. They were always coming over and making life a misery, and that was happened on my 21st birthday party. Mentioned in there, I was... They dropped a bomb and I was unconscious. And everybody left me, and I was lying around for about an hour.
So what happened then?
I got back.
The bomb dropped?
Bopped on Shotley. And I don't know anything at all about it, really. But the girl I was with, she disappeared. But she, you know, she's back again. But I know nothing at all about it at all. I woke up and got back to
So that was the effects of the bomb blast, was it?
It must have been.
That's right.
Might have been what I was doing to the girl, I don't know. She was rather nice, but how anybody liked, loved me at all in those days, I had all my teeth taken out. I had 12 teeth. All my doubles were all rotten. At one hit with not gas, just injections. And they produced a set of dentures for me. And they caught up with me when I went to Devonport. That was 10 weeks later. And they fitted me perfectly and stayed with me for all that time. And I was flying with a top and bottom set of dentures all that. And some people, they were flying with dentures, and when they get a tight turn, bloody things used to slip down. Oh, yes.
So how did the time at Shotley come to an end? How long had you been there, and what was
the... We were there for about 10 weeks, and the story about the end of Shotley was that they were expecting to be invaded, and all the blokes that weren't groomed to go anywhere else, a lot of CW candidates, were given rifles, so we did rifle work and rifle drill and all that sort of thing. They were staying there to defend the beaches, you know, against what was... for me, a notice appeared on the board for Tagetagens in the fleet air arm, and I submitted an application, and I was called in to see the it wasn't Howard Warner. It might have been Howard Warner, I don't know. But I was called in to say, "Well, what do you want to be a tag for?" I said, I want to be in the fleet air arm, sir. He said, "Well, you can't be a tag because they're not commissioned, and you're a CW candidate, and therefore you either go into the Navy proper for commissioning, or you can be a pilot and you can go to HMS St. Vincent." I said, "I'll be a pilot, sir, please." So that was me scheduled as a pilot.
Had you assumed that initially that you wouldn't be allowed to do pilot training? And was that why you applied for a tag, or was it just purely to get into the fleet?
I was a naval rating, period. I was an ordinary seaman with a naval life in front of me as an able seaman and leading a seaman or whatever happened. Except that because of my education and the way I was behaving with the lot, and they didn't know all the things I was doing, but they knew enough. They said I was a CW, Commissioner Warrant Candidate. So I was going to be streamed, if I wanted a commission, if I could have turned one down, that was where I wanted to go. So I said, "Well, I wanted to fly." So I said, "Okay, well, you can be a pilot. You're designated as a pilot." And they filled out the forms and everything else for me as a pilot. And I went to Devonport, which is the next part of the story, really. That's my first meeting with the officialdom. As how I got into the fleet air arm. But by doing that, I was already way ahead of what went on in Vincent, because I'd done an ordinary seaman's course as well as the major requirements of mathematics and physics and chemistry and everything else, navigation, in the fleet air arm proper. So that is a terminal point, really, where I was decided to go as a Devonport. I chose Devonport as a rating. And I went to Devonport Barracks, which was in the December of that year, and it was the bomb in the arsehole of Devonport, and it was a pretty rough old time. So that's really Ganges. The rest is pretty well a blur more than anything else.
Was Vincent at Devonport?
Pardon?
Was HMS Vincent at Devonport?
Devonport, yes. Yeah, that was my port. My DJX 21799. Okay, so it's now about Christmas time of 1940. I go home for leave, go back to Devonport, which is a hell of a long way from Bridlington for starts, which suited me fine. But first of all, we had to get to Devonport, and we were transported to Devonport with all our gear. And my hammock and bags, but no navy kit, no flying kit bags at the moment. I had a big one and a little suitcase. You know all about these aspects, don't you? And a hammock, which had been taught how to tie properly so that it was just a life raft. And you know that? No.
Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Oh yeah. When you joined the Navy as a rating. First of all, in those days, you lived in a hammock. And when you went to the barracks in Pompey, for instance, in transit, you slept in a hammock. And the hammock was issued to you. You were told how to make it into a hammock with all the bits and pieces of string and the knots and ropes and tarry band. And the first thing you learn is to never tie it, when you're hanging it, you never tie it with a slip knot. Because the bloody PO will come down and pull the slips off, and before you know where you are, the first thing in the morning, you're upside down on the floor. And so that's one thing you don't do. But one thing about a hammock was that the first thing they taught you about that, this was part of the training, and I missed it, but that was one of the first things. Part of the kit issue, you get a hammock, and you learn how to pack a hammock and roll it tight so that it fall in the water. You can float on it, and it lasts a long time. It's canvas, and there's a blanket. I've still got my navy blanket here, by the way. I'm still 60 years ago. And what you do, the way you tie a hammock, you tie a rope around and then tie the knot. You don't do it underneath, you tie it over the top. Remember that and pull it tight. And that lash is tight and the two ends are here and you wrap those round. And that goes in a hammock stack. Wherever you are, there was a hammock stack in those days to take it down. So we went down to Davenport with all our kit, with a hammock, nicely rolled, never used, never been in the water, and our kit bags and everything else, in the middle of an air raid. And where do you go in Davenport barracks when there's an air raid on? What do you do with 40 or 50 people? Problem. First of all, they've got to stay somewhere. So they took us into a boat shed with boats where there was a lot of kit and gear and said, there you are, we'll come to you later on. They didn't come to us later on. We had to find out where the food was, where the water was, where we go for a pee, where the loo was and everything else. And we had to sleep there on what was a bare floor with our hammocks. We all slept together side by side with the hammocks between us, so we were reasonably warm. And we stayed at Davenport for a little while. The bombing was too much. And ultimately, we were separated. Some people got drafts and they were away very quickly. I don't remember, but I must have been there for a while because I was... Yes, I'll tell you about that. That I was at Davenport Barracks, and with this introduction of finding our way round, and I know that we were taught deck handling and that sort of thing in Davenport quite clearly, but we were in a barrack situation, and the only thing I remember about Davenport particularly was the beautiful buildings there. They were built of that silver granite. And they really were magnificent, even to me. And we were there, and I cannot tell you how we lived there at all now, but I'll tell you the story of why that came to be, probably, because I don't think I was there too long. But we go to Davenport and we shepherd around from where we were into a covered place, wherever it was, I don't know. And we got notices, we're all being drafted. And I got a draft to a minesweeper called the Cado. Minesweeper? They don't fly airplanes on minesweepers. What do I do? Now, you know the Navy, you must have done because you're doing this all the time. If you want to go and see an officer, you have to see a petty officer. I get permission of the petty officer to go and see them. My divisional officer was a 2.5 naval commander at Davenport Barracks, and I got a draft kit to go to the minesweeper Cado. I went straight along to his office, knocked on the door. Didn't know who I was, what I was. I said, good morning. He says, my name's Hooker. I've got a draft kit to a minesweeper called the Cado. Yes? Why? I said, well, I'm supposed to be a pilot, and I've been allocated as a pilot, and I don't think that of airplanes on minesweepers. So this is me, my 21-year-old cockiness. Oh, dear, he said. You're not very happy then, Hook? No, sir. He cancelled my appointment immediately, and I was immediately transferred to Pompey Barracks, back to Portsmouth. But I got a draft sheet of the Cado, hadn't I, which had been cancelled. So they found somebody else and put him on board that ship. And it sailed while I was there, going out Plymouth Sound, and a Heinkel came over, dropped two bombs on it, sank the bloody ship completely. There were two survivors, one from the ship and me aboard. First, that was my first introduction to the Navy. It's all in that book. So